Hey everybody, welcome back once again to another episode of Brains, Bibles, and Beyond, your favorite theological podcast.
Oh yeah, without a doubt.
Yes, your favorite, my mom's favorite. Saving sheep everywhere. That's a new motto. We're going to start with that one. All right, so we are glad you are here with us. We have another very special episode today. We have a special guest that you will meet in a little while. Mm. But first, we need to grab our theological receptacles.
Our favorite ones.
Our favorite theological receptacle.
And get going.
Oh, yeah. All right. On today's episode of Stump the Theologian.
Yikes.
Scary. We have a write-in question on the text line. You also can text in your questions to me. But you have to figure out my phone number.
Or you just email us.
Well, it's listed on the website. Not that hard.
Definitely.
Go to our website. Today's question. How do you tell a non-believer why God allows bad things to happen? I think it's the specific part of this is a non-believer, because as a Christian, you say, well, you know, God's in control of all these things, right? Like, to help understand. But this is specific to a non-believer who may not, like, just buy the answer, God's good.
Sure,
That's kind of how I'm reading the question.
So I think that really has to be unpacked, because I believe that you'd have to, it's good to have, you know, if at all possible, build a relationship with the person, talk to them. They need to know that you love them, that you're trustworthy, things like that as well. Like that's really helpful. If that's not possible, then, you know, whatever. But if it's a gotcha question, no matter what you say, it's not going to be received well anyways. Sure. So there's just a couple clarifying points there before I actually, you know, just dive into it. One big thing for me is I would ask them, well, who do you think God is? You know, what's your understanding there? If they're just simply asking, like, they think there's an inconsistency with my worldview, then you know, it's a bigger explanation, because we have to talk about who God is, what we mean by allow, what we mean by bad. You know, it's like, hey, if I end up breaking my leg, and then now I can't take the flight with my, you know, sports team to go to this you know, major function, it was the Nationals, but then there's a plane crash. So that the leg breaking, I thought that was so bad, but it actually prevented me from losing my life. So all of a sudden it's good then, you know. So what we have a hard time distinguishing what's bad or good. We have to have a foundation. And we've talked about that. Is God good and stuff? We talked about the morality issues in some other episodes. And so I'll spare a lot of that, but just say that there has to be an objective standard for us to make any moral claim of what's good or bad. And so when you get to the point of, you know, the person and word of God is that objective standard, then you realize he is good. So if he allows something, if he's all powerful and he allows something, there has to be some redemptive purpose. But we also remember that there's a curse of the earth. And so, you know, why the better question, I think, is why is anything good ever happening?
Sure.
We deserve nothing but bad stuff continually to be happening to us all the time. And so the fact that there's anything good, you know, you can say, hey, that plane crash, why did God allow that plane crash? Why did he allow 3 million plane landings? You know, if you're going to give him credit for the bad, you have to give him credit for the good. And so, like, one of my goals there would be consistency. And do you recognize all the good? Are you recognizing that? Why are you giving him credit for all the evil? Why are you thinking that that is just, you know? So kind of asking these probing questions, because ultimately, I don't want to win the argument. I want to win the soul. And so I want to show them Christ. I want to share the gospel effectively. And so instead of just giving that 1-2 punch kind of thing, I think I really want to develop a relationship with this person and have a conversational style discussion, asking a lot of questions to see what their understanding is and help guide them along to understanding Scripture.
Yeah, and help them understand the definitions of these things.
Right, sure. Right. That's important. So that actually becomes a very long discussion.
Why does God allow bad things? Well, what's bad?
So then go to our episode series, God Good? I think it's 4 episode series there.
There's a lot in the Is God Good series.
Yep.
So I end up pointing people to that one a lot, actually, because this is a big question. Some form of that comes up a lot.
Oh, yeah. Very important.
Yep. So, awesome. That's a good. All right, you guys decide. Did we thump the stump the theologian? Did we thump the theologian today? Did we stump the theologian today?
Sounds painful.
Let us know in our comments.
Okay.
And we'll if you got follow up questions, send them to us.
Yeah,
put them in the comments. You know, we like follow ups. If you're like, okay, you know, maybe we can be more specific on a certain thing, sure. how do I ask those follow up questions? Or you know, that didn't answer my question at all. Mm-hmm. I really meant this because yeah. I can misinterpret what came in a text message easily.
Because part of it is you know these quick little answers. You're not addressing every little thing.
And no,
so do ask the questions.
This is meant to be a 5 minute like yeah 3 minute answer.
Yeah,
I mean, 5 minute. Just a quick answer, but get you on the right path. So, and I could be using wrong hermeneutics and reading this text message.
Yeah, right.
And not understanding the intent of the author because of lack of context.
Yep.
Which we'll be talking about more later.
There we go.
In a future episode.
That's right. Coming soon.
All right. So next, we have some semi-local news.
Semi-local. Where at?
This is actually an article out of the UK, but I believe it's about America.
Okay, I was gonna say that's
okay.
Not
okay.
quite local.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So,
so our country.
It's, yeah, and really, I mean, isn't the UK just kind of part of America anyway? Don't we own them? Right.
Oh my goodness! All right, let's move on. What,
all right,
the date of the article.
This article was dated October 3rd, 2024.
Okay. All right.
Okay, so apparently there is a contest in America called the Fat Bear Contest.
Okay.
So what I'm gathering is they have some large plus-size bears. No one wants to be called fat. And they find videos or pictures of them, and they post them on the internet, and the people vote on who they think is the fattest bear.
Wow.
Or prettiest fat bear or something like that. I'm not sure. So there's a tournament. There's an annual tournament. The annual tournament, which pits the biggest bears against each other in an online vote. At first, when I read it, like, I had a tournament, we were just like, is this a bear fight thing? Like, but no, this is... is an online tournament.
Just the
an online vote
obese.
had to be. Yeah, this is like the big pumpkin contest at the state fair or something.
The plus size models of the bear community. Yeah,
had to be held up by one day this week after the incident, which was caught on live video feed. Meanwhile, a 4-time champion is reportedly missing. Okay.
Oh, boy.
So what's this incident that got caught on camera? The start of the annual Fat Bear Week contest in the U.S. was delayed this week after one of the potential contestants was killed by a rival.
Whoa.
Yeah. Both bears were in contention for the 10th anniversary of the tournament, pitting the heaviest bears against each other in an online vote as they finished bulking for hibernation. Caught on a live webcam, a brutal attack involved a male known as Bear 469 and a female called Bear 402 in a river at Alaska's Katmai National Park and Preserve.
There it is.
A naturalist for exploring.org, which streams footage from the park, said the male bear's challenge appeared predatory, as if he was triggered in the middle of something. All right.
Interesting.
So even millennial bears are getting triggered. This is ridiculous.
Okay.
This is a difficult situation to witness. We love to celebrate the success of bears with full stomachs and ample body fat, but a ferocity of bears is real. The risks they face are real. Their lives can be hard and their deaths can be painful.
Wow.
The video, at around the 7-minute mark, shows the bears fighting in the river with the female seemingly overpowered and appearing to drown before the male drags her body to land. After the incident, the reveal for Fat Bear Week bracket, which confirms the 12 heavyweight bears who qualified, was postponed by a day. And a death.
I didn't realize it was so intense.
I didn't know this was a thing.
So that bear was really bulking up, getting another bear.
Yeah. So
So that was the way to win.
How do you get the biggest bear? You eat another bear.
I guess so.
National parks like Katmai protect not only the wonders of nature but also the harsh realities. Each bear seen in the webcams is competing with others to survive. Wow. Meanwhile, legendary fat bear Otis, Bear 480, is missing, according to Explore.org's TikTok feed and media reports. Otis won the first tournament and went on to win another three to become the most decorated bear in the competition's history.
You can Google, or just whatever search engine, these fat bears. I just put in fat bear contest, went to images, and there's all sorts of these pictures, and it might be kind of fun. And they have some interesting name. The one, Fabulous Flab. That was one. And I saw one that was Thick Boy, spelt in a more slangy way. And there's others like that, too. It's kind of Chunk and Grazer over there.
Chunk and Grazer? Nice.
Yeah. So that's. Oh, there's Otis. You mentioned Otis.
There he is. He's 4-time champion.
Yeah, Otis. Well, I could tell.
He's missing, though. They didn't say why he's missing.
He got tired of the spotlight. He's not
the one who got eaten.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's too many bears that could eat Otis, looking at him.
he's a 4-time champion.
At least not finish. Okay. Yeah, this is interesting. Fat bear countdown.
Yeah, fat bear. It's been going on for 10 years. How have I never heard of this?
That seems like it should have been alerted to me much earlier.
How did they describe this? Ample stomach size? Ample body fat. So as a man of ample body fat, I mean, I feel like I should have.
We should be knowing about these
things. I should have known about this contest. Yeah. And why do we not have posters up on the wall of Otis goodness. Or somebody?
This is great.
This is good. So anyway, even amongst animals, there are rivalries apparently, and they're not. It's not uncommon to maybe knock off your rival. So. And I love how even those millennial bears get triggered over things like
triggered.
Triggered. Yeah. It says triggered.
Yes. Well, they are wild animals.
Yeah. Yeah.
It happens.
So I don't. Yeah. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah.
So next we have a special guest coming on our podcast.
Yes.
I'm Rebecca Haney. And we will introduce her in a minute. And I hope you guys stick around and listen. Fantastic information. Great interview. It was a pleasure having Rebecca on. Okay. All right. Hey, everybody. We are back once again with another special guest on the Brains, Bible, and Beyond podcast.
Yes.
So, Joel, why don't you introduce our guest here?
Yes, this is the famous Rebecca Haney and host of FaithWorks Live. And I've had the privilege to be on her podcast a few times. Really enjoyed our time together, talking about lots of cool stuff. And that's for, I don't want to mess up the name, is it the Theological Thursdays? Is that what it is?
Oh, yeah.
That's what it's called. Well,
and we can get theological every day, but especially when you're around, Joel.
That's right.
Nice.
We have a lot of fun. And Rebecca's a very knowledgeable person and C.S. Lewis buff. Mm-hmm. Big time reader, and so we have a few things in common there. We enjoy our conversation, so glad to have you on board. We're talking about a very important issue today, issue, and maybe a little bit different. I do a lot of apologetic type stuff, and so I'm not going to really go there so much today. I want to be a little bit more on the practical, like everyday life kind of side of this conversation. But addressing the pro-life issue, which, that's, of course, a big hot topic, and it should be. It's important. It's huge. And so we want to make sure we're doing things biblically. We want to do things that honor God, give him glory, build up the saints. We want to follow his will and the way, not just the conclusion, but like the way we do things. So that's a good setup there. So. I think we'll start with this here. Rebecca, what is the most succinct way that you can say this issue is of a fundamental significance in your own way?
Well, I think it is the first and most fundamental freedom. And not to maybe to paraphrase Ronald Reagan here, who is another one of the heroes that I've read far too much about, that life is the most fundamental right because without that, you can't have any others. It precedes all others. If we don't agree, and I think it's foundational to the Christian worldview. So if you love Jesus like I do, then this makes sense. We go back to Genesis 1 and we see that each and every one of us, both male and female, forever, for all time, are created just like the first ones in God's image. We're created uniquely. We're created intentionally by our all-knowing, all-loving Heavenly Father and have the amazing privilege and dignity of being born in His image. And just in that one little passage, that differentiates the Judeo-Christian worldview from any other one out there. In no other religion or belief system, especially not the main competition for this, which is naturalistic evolution these days, and that's sort of the fundamental world view. But the Christian worldview is so different because of that thought right there, that foundation that there is a God and that He made us specifically, intentionally, and alike. In dignity, different in function, both male and female, but that He made us alike in dignity. And then from there, we can both reproduce, we can be fruitful and multiply, and that is a good thing. That is very, very good. That the sustaining of life and the procreation, the creating of new life, is in fact a beautiful blessing that God has given us as the human race. And that means a couple of things. I know this wasn't as succinct as you probably wanted, but that means a couple of things. It means that every time we look at another human being, we're looking at another creation that is probably different from us in many ways because God loves variety, but that they are here intentionally for God's own purpose in God's own image. And that changes everything about how you think about them, about how you treat them. It makes perfect sense then, if you fast forward to when Jesus was asked what the greatest commandment is. He said two. He said the first is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. But the second is like unto it, meaning because of that, and in this way, we then love our neighbor as ourself. So life has to be paramount and the protection of every life, because every life is equally valuable and equally created by God. So there's no way that we can pick and choose which humans are worth protecting and which ones are not. And then we understand we are to love as we follow Christ. We're to love our neighbors as we love ourselves because God first loved us. It's motivated in love. It's motivated in an understanding of natural rights instituted by our Creator.
Very good. It
That's
is
good.
hard to be succinct with those things. That's
Podcast
okay.
over. That was
There
great.
we go.
That
Yeah,
was
we're done. That's
I kept
no, we
talking. I
need
didn't see the mute button, so I kept on
it.
talking.
Yeah.
Oh
Oh
yeah.
yeah, I control the mute
I told you we need to invest in one of
button.
those.
Yeah,
I
me.
said.
I can only mute myself right now. Yeah.
Yeah, we need to I think there's a common accusation out there for pro-life people that would be something like you only care about the babies, you know.
Yeah, no, that's one of the new arguments, but really coming up in the last couple of years. I've been hearing it a
Yeah,
ton.
kind of old with new packaging,
Yeah,
maybe,
well,
you
like,
know.
sure, yeah.
Yeah. But the idea is, you know, that's really a straw man kind of a deal. And it's almost like if you don't have a bunch of kids adopted or you're fostering or something that proof you don't really care, you know, or whatever. But that's not true. And even if you don't have the means to do those things or whatever, it doesn't mean you don't care. That doesn't make any sense, right? So just have a conversation with somebody and figure that out. But
Sure.
I people that I know, a large amount of them, I think we all care about all life. And as Rebecca was saying, how they bear the image of our creator and things, we recognize that through every stage of maturity. Unborn to going to the grave, you know, kind of a thing. That's it's consistent. So I think it's a valuable thing to keep in mind. So we have a pro-life issue because that's what's being argued about. No one is arguing of the worth of the 15-year-old. It's the worth of the unborn, and that's why we're focusing on that. So I think it's an important distinction there. Rebecca, you want to speak to that?
Sure, absolutely. Well, there's a couple of different accusations, and believe you me, I've heard some doozies. But I will say that we can't necessarily limit the life discussion to just preborn human beings, but those are the ones that have no one to speak for them.
Right.
literally have no one to speak for them. And if we're called to honor God's commandment to speak up for the vulnerable, to rescue those who are led away to slaughter, to stand in the gap for the innocent, then I don't know that there's much that if it's hard to think of another cause that should motivate us more than to stand for the most innocent, the most vulnerable among us, to speak up for those who are literally being slaughtered as though. And I don't mean to scandalize people to say this, but we have to understand the gravity of what we're talking about. These are literally human beings that are being snuffed out, that are being suffocated, that are being ripped apart, that are being then pieced back together and thrown out in the garbage.
Yep.
These are human beings. And if these were, that's another common comeback, right? If these were puppies, we would have riots in the streets. Yeah, if these even like if they were turtle, like pick your favorite cute fuzzy animal, if they were being experimented on in labs, I mean, my goodness, can you imagine? And that would be heinous as well. But we're doing even worse to our own babies, our own defenseless children. And it's really, you know, fresh in my mind because I was watching a clip with Jill Stanek, who's actually an acquaintance of mine. She was a former nurse at an abortion facility. And she was recounting the thing that turned her heart from that. And it was seeing a little boy in the soiled utility closet, which is where they put living babies who survived the abortion attempt. And she watched him expire. She watched him. She described him. She said he was aborted because he had Down syndrome. He was 21 and a half weeks along. He was about as big as her hand. He couldn't move because he had to spend all of his energy just trying to breathe. He lived for 45 minutes in a soiled utility closet before they threw him out with the garbage. That's what we're doing to our children. And we have to understand the gravity of that before we come back. And I think we deal with this too much theoretically. We say, well, you only care about babies until they're born, or you don't care about the mom. That is so not true. That's demonstrably not true. Look at the name of every hospital that you're going to come across today. They're going to be names like Mercy, Grace. They're going to be named after saints. They're going to be named because people who followed the name of Christ decided we're going to help care for those people who cannot care for themselves because they're worth it, because they are in God's image. We want to seek to love them. Far and away, the biggest demographic that adopts, that fosters, are people who claim the name of Christ. Yeah. So, I mean, just come back to me with your statistics on that, as far as I can tell. But this is not compassion, and this is not caring. It's also not caring for women to invade their bodies in this way, either with chemicals or with these medical instruments to cause the body to, that's in the one place that's supposed to be safe, that's supposed to, that designed to carry life, to work against itself in such a way as we suffer the evil consequences of that. This is violence against women. Every single time, every single abortion, no matter how it's perpetuated, is violence against the body of the woman as well as the body of the child, and leaves her with scars, both physical and psychological. There are women who die in the pursuit of, in the attempt of, and in the aftermath of abortions, botched or other. We call them botched abortions, but really the intent of the abortion, let's just define our terms, is to intentionally kill a preborn child.
Yeah.
And very few abortionists, if any, that I have heard of, offer any sort of follow-up care whatsoever. They will send the gal to the emergency room out the back way so nobody thinks anything of it, so there's no scandal on the clinic. They do not care if their hallways are large enough to fit gurneys. Like tables to help women in emergency situations. They don't expect medical professionals to have admitting privileges, just on and on and on. This is not a question of women's health. This is dangerous for women no matter what. And that's not surprising because it's a profit motivation. They make money off of this procedure every single time. And what they're looking for is to expand the pipeline.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Are there actually statistics on like how many women have complications in a botched abortion? Is there statistics on that?
There are. They're not extensive because there's a concerted effort to cover things up, as you might imagine. And then when we do come up with cases, I mean, one of the most remarkable cases as we sit here today that's been bandied about for the last month or two has been the case of Amber Thurman in Georgia, and there have been at least two others in a similar time frame in two other areas where there were women who pursued abortions or abortion medication and had such severe complications that it ended up costing their lives as well as the lives of their preborn children. And each case can vary, but then the pro-abortion side takes that and runs with it and says, oh, see, the problem was really that there were pro-life protections that were out there. You evil pro-lifers were the ones that stopped this woman from killing her child closer to home, and therefore you're the ones that are responsible for her death. It seems almost sociopathic to me to say the problem is that we're going to try to harm your child, that this cost a woman her life, and now we want more of this.
Yeah. Well, because, you know, one of the arguments, I mean, you always hear it, oh, what about for the life of the mother? Well, how many of the lives of the mothers are actually being harmed by the abortion? Mm-hmm. And that's my curiosity.
I would recommend, on the subject of statistics, you can go to like the Charlotte Lozier Institute, and they have some really good statistics that are there. There's Let Them Live. They collect statistics as well. So there's some good resources that are out there for what we do have. I just want to recognize that because we're relying on, so there's the Guttmacher Institute, which is an arm of Planned Parenthood, basically. It's their own reporting agency, relying on the abortionists to report the casualties of their abortions. And yeah, so we don't get, there might be some skewed numbers, but the Charlotte Lozier Institute is a pro-life source for this type of information. And then the Guttmacher Institute is one of the main sources that comes from Planned Parenthood.
Yes. I mean, as a general rule, if your livelihood is made by killing babies, I don't necessarily trust your statistics anyway, but
just saying,
How do you spell that? Guttmacher, or is that German? Or
I presume so. Okay, it's Guttmacher, I believe.
Okay.
And then Lozier is spelled Lozier, Charlotte Lozier.
All right. Yeah, I got those. Good, good. All right, we can have those in the description for people too.
We'll put those in.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Awesome. All right. So there's so for a little bit of the Bible type stuff, so this would be, I understand if someone's totally against scripture and whatnot anyways, they're kind of like, well, who cares? But just to show that there's some significance here for those of us who believe that might be skewed by a secular worldview, two things I'd like to mention. There's more, but two things I'd like to mention, John the Baptist leaping in his mother's womb as the Messiah came near. There was a recognition, there was activity, there was somebody found precious, not born. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's two. A really good one. Two, absolutely. Yeah.
Two the Messiah, recognizable two. People who are those persons before they're born.
They are completely those persons. Then the other one I find fascinating, because a lot of people even attack the idea of the old patriarchal system. Women are nothing, nobody's nothing, which I don't think is true. I don't think that was actually the case with Israel and all that. But you have like Exodus 21, and this is, of course, part of the law and whatnot. But starting verse 22, interesting situation here. When men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined, even if there's no harm, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, and he shall pay as the judges determine.
Just make it up.
Then it says, but if there is harm, okay, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. So the idea, though.
So it's a capital punishment then. Does it say life for life?
If the child dies.
Yeah.
So. What I love about this is it's any stage of development,
there's no qualifications for how far along.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how important, productive, contributing this man's society is. It doesn't matter. This full grown man.
Yeah.
He's fighting another guy, accidentally biffs the pregnant lady. And if that, whatever happens to that child, it's going to happen to you, buddy.
Which is why they have boxing matches and rings. Make sure nobody else gets hit.
There we go.
Also, men shouldn't hit women.
Right. Yeah, that's, I agree. It's a bad deal there.
Should not do that, especially pregnant ones.
Right. Well, and what's interesting, Joel, not to interrupt if you want to continue, but that passage is actually used by the quote unquote pro-choice Christians as well, because they adopt this idea. It's eisegetical for sure. But what they're doing is they say, well, it's as if harm should come, then, you know, all you got to do is pay a fine. So what they're interpreting is to say, well, if they're, you know, basically the child isn't really that important anyway. So they're reading into it that if the baby, you know, is because the baby's not really a person, then that means like, all you got to really do is pay a fine. But if harm should come to the woman, that so they flip it almost on its head from the way that you read it and interpreted, which I think is faithful. But they'll flip it on its head and say, well, really, the woman is the important one in the equation. And so the baby is just, you know, just pay a fine. It's not as equal in humanity. But what they don't see is that there's nowhere in there that says that this is supposed to be only about this woman. It's very clear, I think, from the context. If you aren't reading it to support abortion, you just there's no way that that picture makes sense other than what you just outlined, Joel, which is an explicit valuing of the preborn child. Because when what's supposed to be, again, the safest environment for that child is disrupted, and clearly it's not good for the mom either. Again, this is a violent situation that we're talking about, even accidentally. I can't think of anything worse than intentionally perpetrating that on women. Something like that on women and saying, well, this violence is good. This violence is kindness. This violence is compassion. And you can choose it. And what's more, it's being pushed on women as more than just a choice. Most women are told it is the choice. It is the option for your equality. You can't really raise a baby on your own. You can't do this. I mean, he's going to suffer. It's not even a he or she at this point, right? It's just it's just a blob of cells. Just you're not going to be able to finish your education. It'll get in the way of your career. You won't really be equal to men unless you're going to be stuck in that Handmaid's Tale dystopian future as a breeding machine, which is all just nonsense, utter, complete nonsense.
Right. Yeah.
But it's being perpetuated against women to couch pure and utter barbaric violence against us. And it's pure and simple. And I don't mean to shock anyone when I say that. I just think we have to be honest about our terms, especially if we're claiming the name of Christ. And yet we make exceptions based on what we believe to be compassionate, because it means that those lies from the devil have actually taken root in our own heads, that says that sometimes we can do evil that good may come, that it's evil in every other situation, but sometimes it's necessary. And I don't think that's true. I don't think that's consistent with the word of God.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And sometimes they'll mention there's a miscarriage, and which my wife has gone through, many others have gone through.
For sure. Yeah.
And they'll say like the body aborted it, you know, kind of a thing. They use the terminology.
And yeah, or like, natural abortion is the terminology. Yeah. Yep.
And which I like to distinguish away from using that, even those words, because of the association. But the idea is that we were trying, we loved to have life. Yeah. We wanted to maintain that life. And through things out of our control, completely out of our control, we lost that life. That's completely different than saying, I hate this idea of a thing growing in me and I will destroy it because it's more convenient for my life. You know, that sort of a mentality. That's completely different. So many times I've seen those things pushed together as like, well, what's the difference? You know, your body does it, the doctor does it, whatever, right? It's horrible to put those things together.
Right. And it's the intent makes all the difference, truly. Also, the practice makes all the difference, truly. Abortion is the intentional killing of a preborn human life. The fact that a child that you dearly loved and wished for and prayed for and, you know, did everything that you could to give that child a wonderful upbringing, you know, even when he or she is still in utero, picking out names, picking out little clothes, and then to discover that through no fault of your own, that child has died. And that, you know, you won't get the chance to hold him or her. I mean, that's heartbreaking. Yep. It's heartbreaking. And in no way is that equivalent to push the intentional destruction of a child you refuse to even dignify as fellow human. And It's particularly just bothersome to me as, I hate to use the as a woman card, but
Yes.
having been through the loss of a child, mine was a little bit different. He died after about 5 weeks in the NICU. He was born at 26 and a half weeks. His name is Gabriel. And we got a chance to see him and hold him and get to know him. But having lost a child that we dearly loved, and it's like, please don't insult me. Please don't insult me and the many other couples, mothers and fathers that grieve for the loss of our children. It is not the same thing. And I think the medical community is kind of complicit in this because they have adopted this abortion language to obfuscate, specifically so that they can cover it and say, well, you know, if a miscarriage or a DNC or, you know, treatment for ectopic pregnancy or things like that, which are often brought up now, is then all just covered over with this term of abortion. See, then you can't regulate it because then you can't deny women care on this side. And then the intentional and wanton destruction of millions of our own preborn children is all just kind of the same thing, right? It's these foggy sort of false equivalencies. And we that's why we have to be specific about our terms. People also are very afraid. So when you hear these terms, I've seen campaign commercial after campaign commercial. It's all just being tagged with abortion. They want to make it so that women die in the back out. Like, that's the farthest thing from what pro-lifers want to do. We actually do want to care and love and support both women and the babies that are involved here, and the dads as well, for that matter, because they're getting left out of the equation entirely. Hello, someone needs to speak up for lost fatherhood. So just put that in the suggestion box. But we've got to start realizing that we cannot allow killing to masquerade as care. Killing is not compassion. Right. Killing is not healthcare. It's not good for mom or baby. And those are the premises that you have to understand, I think, and be very have very solid footing in that when you wade into this discussion, because you will hear heartrending stories, real stories of people that have gone through real pain and have real either guilt or trauma that are attached to these types of things. Almost everyone you know, and I think the statistics are like 1 in 3, between 1 in 3 and 1 in 4 women have chosen abortion or have been forced into that as a decision. And so if it's not you, it's someone you know. So these are real people. It's not just theoretical. And what I hate to see often derail this discussion is that people allow one person's pain to dictate the destruction of another. And what you have to do is love them both, right? Love them all. And killing is not care. Killing is not kindness. The truth is love sacrifices. Love sacrifices of ourselves. We give of ourselves to love, just like Christ did. We give whatever it takes to help love that person in need, the vulnerable that's before us. That is not abortion. Abortion is not kindness. It's kind to love and care for all the people involved in that situation.
Yes,
I was going to say, so what, I mean, what do you say then to, you know, well, you're taking away the woman's, you know, rights. You know, that's really what it comes. That's the big. That's always the big argument. You're taking away the rights. You know, don't they have the right to choose things? Which
I am a woman. I'm very pro women's rights.
Yeah,
I care.
Right.
Like, this affects me. What
we all are, right?
We have as it depends. Depends on the day.
Well,
but I. I feel that argument, that can be a powerful argument. The problem is you're presuming that your right extends to another person, and it really doesn't. I mean,
exactly.
The old is that the Blakean philosophy that says that my rights begin, or I can swing my fist anywhere that I want until I hit your face. Like, there's we all recognize that there's a limit to our inherent rights. So we should defend my right to life, my right to liberty, my right to property, whatever that may be. But I don't have the right to take your property. I don't have the right to take your liberty. And I don't have the right to take your life. I think we understand this on a basic level.
Yeah.
And we would understand this if I were holding the baby in front of me.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It would be wrong to snuff out a sweet little child sleeping defenselessly in his crib. But somehow that same child, just maybe a week earlier, can be snuffed out in the safest spot, which is his mother's womb. And no one's going to speak up for that because that was suddenly her choice. If it's her child in front of her, what about that 7 weeks and that 7 inches of difference in position determines whether or not you can kill this little person? It's the same person in a different position.
Right.
And until we just get serious and honestly scientific about this, there's no excuse. There's no way that you can say that it's not the same entity, that it's not the same person. But we've justified this for so long because we, again, think the ends justify the means. That's not a Christian perspective. I'm sorry, folks. It's just, it's simply not. And so I'm unafraid to speak boldly about this. It's not to say that I've gotten everything right along my pro-life journey either. And I know we're going to be discussing different strategies, different ways that we can approach this specific issue, idea, understanding. But I will say that we have to acknowledge the humanity that's involved here. And to say, I have a choice. I mean, I've literally heard now the argument that we're reducing our babies to parasites. Mm-hmm. To say, we understand that there's, you know, another, maybe they'll acquiesce to the idea that it's another living thing, but they call it a parasite, and you don't have the right now to my body. And I'm like, no, a parasite is an invading species. This is your offspring. This is your child. Like, this is how we all came into the world. And I'm really glad your mama didn't feel that way. I mean, I sure hope not. Like, it belies all logic. It belies all consistency. We wouldn't talk about ourselves that way. We wouldn't talk about a 15-year-old that way, even though I got teenagers. Like, it's a challenge.
Yeah, talk about a parasite.
It is. You know? But you wouldn't talk about, like, you know, go out and
somebody leeching
earn
off
your
of
keep.
Me.
Earn your keep, kiddos. But between toddlers or teenagers, we wouldn't talk about them that way. But it is, we are reducing, again, the most precious, the most vulnerable among us because of circumstances. Typically, it's either, it's preference. It can be as blithe as just, I don't feel like being a mom. And so I'm going to do a little TikTok dance while I take my abortion pills. Like, there's a very flippant attitude that I would think the minority of women have. But it's almost like they have to believe that it means nothing. I think there is some desperation there that says it has to mean nothing. It has to be just an easy little, like, watch me abort my child on TikTok kind of thing. I think the vast majority of women that are pursuing this are in some type of desperate circumstance that they don't believe that they have the proper support, or this is not according to their plan. And the majority of women, post-abortive women, when they are polled, said that if they had support from just one other person in their lives to tell them, you know what, you can do this. You're not going to be alone. I just was reading again the story of Maya Angelou, and I've got it up on our Facebook page if anybody is interested. But she had a teenage pregnancy, and she was hiding it because she was scared until she was quite far along. And she had the support of her mother. Basically, she left her a note because she didn't want to confront her. And her mama said, you know, are you and this boy going to get together? And she said, no. And the mama said, well, then there's no point in ruining three lives. We're going to have our baby. We're going to have our baby. And so she had a child as a teenager, and she went on to do great things and accomplish great things. And in her own words, and later on, when she felt like she was in a position to have kids, she actually couldn't for whatever reason. So she said, thank God I had my son at 16. Thank God that basically what was an evil situation or a disappointing, just not according to plan. Unplanned. There we go. In that unplanned situation, she found the glory in that, and he became such a blessing to her. And there are thousands and thousands and thousands of stories just like that. Because when women have support, they truly do recognize, the vast majority of the time, they recognize the value of the life that they're carrying. They truly want to be empowered to do well. Or, you know, maybe they are not in a position to be parents and they can place for adoption, because there are thousands of couples that are waiting right now to adopt children. I mean, we talk about a fertility crisis sometimes in the country. I think the answers are right in front of us. The answers are to love and to treat and value every single human being the way that God has made them, the way God intended, to see them through the eyes of Christ. And when we do that, when we look at people not as the problem, which is what the abortion industry does, they put all the blame on the baby and say, the baby is the problem. You're being punished with a baby. That's what Barack Obama said. You shouldn't allow that little girl to be punished with a baby. Yeah, that is not the situation. And we cannot let that view creep in that says, oh, well, the baby's a burden. No, it's not. He or she is lovingly created at this time, at this moment, regardless of circumstance, in the image of God for a specific purpose. And all we have to do is to acknowledge them, to love them, and to care for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's lots of times that I can be burdensome to my wife.
Oh, sure, yeah.
I'm sure glad she didn't just choose to kill me.
Right. Well, and we again, it's laughable if we were to apply that to any other situation and any other person, but it would never, ever justify it. That's why, again, I kind of like laugh a snide at the assertion that, well, it's a woman's right to choose. Like, I can choose whatever I want about my own life. I do not have the choice to destroy another life just because I consider it inconvenient or in the way. And again, it's right in our faces. It's the only logical extension of what we already know to be true. It also applies to preborn humans. And the only reason that it wouldn't is because you want to destroy them. Now, why would somebody want to destroy preborn human beings? Well, on a mass scale, I understand each situation might be a little bit different, but why would a giant multi-billion dollar industry want to make a living off of destroying human lives?
A lot of good questions there. What I like to say with women's rights, women's health, I'll say, yes, I support that, even if they're unborn. You know, what happens to women's rights, women's health if they're unborn? Like, it doesn't make any sense. It's very inconsistent.
One of the craziest experiences I had was when so our youngest is our little girl, Alethea, whom we love, and she thinks she's a princess, so that could be a problem later. But I think... But she has been by my side for a lot of things. I used to have to bring her into the studio just because we were connected, and that's the way that God worked it. And so I brought her to a political event that happened to have some protesters outside when we left. And so I'm thinking, okay, safety. She's on my front carrier. I've got this little girl, little baby girl with me. And I happened to talk to one of the protesters who was holding a sign that said something like Republicans hate women or something very akin to that. It was brought up in her placard. And I said, really, why do you think that? I'm a woman. You know, I'm a woman. I don't think that these people hate me. And let's talk about it. And she brought up abortion. I said, well, you know, my little girl had rights before she was born. Are you saying that, you know, she shouldn't be here? What about her rights? And it was just an interesting look on this woman's face to be confronted literally in between us was my little baby girl. And to say that we care about women's rights, but we're going to kill tiny women and men in the name of women's rights. What about hers? You know, what about his? That it's so self-contradictory, and it's so easy when you just stop to think one step removed from the question. I think we just have to maybe engage in this a little bit more. I think there have been people, especially men, that have been shut out of the discussion because they say, well, it's a women's issue, you can't speak to any of this, no uterus, no opinion, like all the again flippant kind of talking points. It's my choice, it's my body, you don't have the right to speak to this. First of all, we're talking about humanity, and I'm a human, so we all got a stake in that. We're also talking about fathers and mothers, which it takes to produce every single child on human earth or on this whole earth here in human experience. But you can't use that as an argument and then say, yeah, but some women don't count.
Right.
Yeah. No, I agree.
So with this is a, you know, important issue here. So with this whole thing, and as people are, you know, using their political opportunities, voting and things to promote good life-saving measures, you know.
Yep.
Then there's basically, and this is really oversimplification, but get a generalization here, but you essentially have groups that would say, I'm only going to support any legislation that is at absolute zero, and then you have another group that says, you know, zero abortions, and then the other group that says, I want to get there. But right now I'm focusing just pushing that meter, and to some degree, it almost doesn't matter what the legislation is, as long as it's pushing the meter towards zero. And so I know that's, like I said, it's a generalization. But I just wanted you to speak to that, the tension that's there, and how even a spinoff of that is how we should be treating each other when we do disagree here. And then even, of course, we already mentioned, you know, loving our opposition, I think, a little bit, but, so all those things together, go ahead, please.
Well, if you had to pick a can of worms designed to make me go off, sir, this is the one. I've been around this for a long time. All right. It makes me feel old to admit that, but it's true, for decades now in pro-life activism, and specifically in my state and somewhat at the national level. But I have seen this argument crop up time and time again. And I think that at especially maybe at like 10 years ago, and it's still relevant today, but it was necessary to wake up what had become the overall pro-life movement that activated in response to Roe v. Wade specifically. So for 50 years, this conversation has been going on. If you've been involved even longer than I have, you're well aware that this exists. So I think the push for abortion unified initially, but then we started getting into arguments over strategy, especially in the 90s. You had things like the Partial Birth Abortion Act, which was touted as a pro-life victory, but in actuality, I think really missed the mark. And not just that, but that's an example of legislation like that, where I will just say at the outset that I'm a fan of first and foremost, the goal should be no killing. Let's stop the killing of preborn children, period, yeah. Point blank. If the right to life extends to every human created in his image, then that's what our laws should protect. There should be no exceptions to that because God doesn't make exceptions. He doesn't say some people are worth more and others are worth less depending on what? On their gender, on their race, on their circumstance, on their social status, on their ability or disability as the case may be. He doesn't make exceptions and neither should we. So that's my call to action right there. But there's also the question of strategy. And as we look around us today, it's very clear that there's so many lies that the enemy has perpetuated in the world that we have believed that put us in the position of not being able to recognize the individual human worth. So we have a lot of work to do is the easy way to put it. But for decades, we've been striving over which approaches are the best. And I'm a fan of going back to the underlying philosophy that says each person is created in the image of God. If each person has the inherent right to life that's already protected by the 15th or by the 5th and the 14th Amendments, 14th Amendment was later necessary to extend that to Black Americans, Americans born in slavery, for us to recognize what our initial law should have but didn't. And I see it in much the same way now, where we have a class of human beings that is created in the image of God that has the constitutional as well as the inherent right to life, and that should not be deprived of them without due process of law. That should extend to preborn humans as well, because they are also people made uniquely, again, either seen from the natural law perspective or in the perspective of the creator. Now, the concern about things like that is that I would say people just don't, not enough people understand that in order to vote for a measure like that. And then the question is, how does it pass Congress? And, you know, what about the executive? And how do we get the legalities to be seen to is another question. The state-by-state approach is the biggest one that's on the table right now. The problem I have with that is that we've already seen what that leads to. When some states start saying, well, these are people, and other states say, no, they're not, you can destroy them at will for any reason at any length of time, that only leads to conflict. So I think philosophically, that's not consistent, again, with what we know to be true. But to your broader question, Joel, what I would say is that we have to be careful. So I've been on all sides of this. I really have. I've been a part of an organization that seeks to promote personhood, which is what I just outlined, to say that because every person is human, every person deserves the protection of life under the 5th and 14th Amendments. That would be true. All we have to do is recognize that, either state by state or nationally. So that, I think, could be an effective approach. And it derives specifically from the original Roe v. ruling and some of the testimony from Justice Blackmun that said exactly that. That if a preborn child could be established as a person under the 5th or 14th Amendments, that there would be no case for abortion. There would be no defense for the entire industry of Planned Parenthood. And the Planned Parenthood attorney laughs and agrees that that is the case. So I think that's an effective strategy. But right now we're taking there's a lot of other approaches that are out there. Typically you hear arguments about weeks, about, you know, viability, about circumstances of conception. So I will just say that as the pro-life community, we have fought over many of these things. The problem that I have is that when people who adopt a holistic strategy that says we're going to prohibit all abortion, and I'm for that, the other side, the incrementalist side, typically votes against them. So people who would say that they are pro-life, I've seen it happen where they've tanked bills that would advocate personhood or abolition or whatever term you might apply there, where it says we're just not going to have abortions in our state, The other people would say, well, this is a problem because it's going to be misconstrued. It's going to fail. And so they essentially ensure that that fails because they don't believe that it's the right strategy. And that is a betrayal of our principle, I think. Now, on the other side, what I have grown a little bit in this area is to say that there is such a thing as principled incrementalism. I used to not believe that was the case. I used to think, well, any bill that allows any abortion is not okay. It's a compromise and we're not going to do it. I don't believe that anymore because I've seen people and I've talked to people whose lives were literally saved by things like 15-week abortion bans where the mom heard, okay, this is not legal now, so I'm going to have my baby, or even the heartbeat bills that have passed in our own state now that have been allowed to go into effect after being tied up in court. And there are women who are now reconsidering their choices and are willing to go to more pro-life clinics and resources and end up delivering their children as a result. I think that is all a good thing. That's a measurable good. The problem, again, is it has to be principled incrementalism. So it is, I would say, any bill or any legislative effort or approach that specifically highlights certain lives that are not worthy of protecting is not our principles. It contradicts our principles. So to say, well, we can protect these babies, but not if they were conceived in rape, not if they, you know, were conceived as a matter of abuse and incest, things like that. Hello, those are the babies most in need of protection. They're the most vulnerable. Those are the children that deserve the most consideration and our sympathy, and as well as the victims in those cases. Why on earth should we punish a child for the crimes of their father? People don't tend to make those cases and those connections because we're so used to the emotional kind of knee-jerk reflex. And I think we have to think more consistently about that. I think there is such a thing as principled incrementalism. I think we can get to the goal in different ways. Again, the devil is out there working overtime to try and deceive people about the humanity of the preborn child. So we need to tell those stories. But I will say that a bill can be called pro-life or an effort can be called pro-life and also be working against our fundamental principles. And like I just outlined, I think any legislative effort that specifically highlights certain people or certain practices where they say, well, again, like the partial birth abortion ban, they say, well, this type of destruction is wrong and illegal, but these other types of destruction are not covered under the law. And so you can go ahead and do those all day long if you want. That is anti-life. That is not a pro-life approach. So we have to look at what the bill actually accomplishes. There can also be a lot of calculated misunderstandings surrounding certain things. And we see the left is really good at doing this specifically. But I mean, it can happen on any side of any political aisle. We have to be better informed about exactly what these bills will do and be wise and shrewd as to unintended consequences as well. I've seen a good development in recent legislation where you have specific delineations of exactly what we mean by abortion, exactly what we mean to say things like treatment for miscarriage is not considered abortion, treatment for ectopic pregnancy, not considered that a woman can get all of these procedures. None of this is banned. None of this is, you know, going to be out of reach for women for legitimate medical care, treatment for ovarian cancer, things like that. And they've highlighted all of those things to make sure that the only thing that we're talking about is the intentional destruction of the preborn human life. Did that answer your question, Joel?
That was really good.
And how should we treat one another, right? Because there has been a lot of animosity build up in the pro-life community over this, especially as we see different strategies. And I talk to people and I have friends on every single side, you know, some of which speak to me more frequently than others these days. But the problem that occurs is we continue to make one side sees the other side as though they're compromised. And one side sees the other one as like the Don Quixote Crusader. I think those are sort of the two extremes that we have. Where one is just, you know, they're the betrayers. They're just as bad as pro-abortion. They're just a little less pro-abortion. I'm like, that's a pretty stern accusation. It better be true. If you're speaking that strongly about especially a fellow brother or sister in Christ, it better be true. And there are times when it has been true. There are times when people claim pro-life, but then when they're called to vote on any of these bills. They literally run. They run from the room to avoid having to go on the record for this. And there are, I guess, like traitors in our midst as far as that goes. You have to look at somebody's voting record and not just the claim, hey, I'm pro-life, vote for me. Like it goes deeper than that, and we're responsible for those choices. So that's a PSA for another day. As we approach those choices, be mindful of this, shall we? But then the other side tends to say, well, you guys are just pie in the sky dreamers because they've already assented to, again, the lie of the enemy that says, you'll never stop this. You'll never stop this. We're always going to have a, it's almost like the poor you will always have with us. There's always going to be abortion. There's always going to be that. So we have to just limit the killing as much as we can. And so they have forgotten that the goal line is all the way at the other end of the field. They're happy at the 50-yard line. They keep moving the goalpost and they're like, well, okay, I guess we'll just be satisfied with whatever breadcrumbs fall from this proverbial table. And so the other side looks at that and they're like, have we forgotten why we're in this and why we're doing this? And so I will say, covering all of that, you also have to be kind to people. Like, if you're pro-life, then you're supposed to be pro-people, and that means the people that you're also disagreeing with. And so it's a complex thing to look at someone with whom you vehemently disagree in terms of strategy, and then also say, "I love you because Christ loved me. I think you're doing this harmfully, or I think you're confused. I don't understand why you see it that way, but I'm going to commit to treating even our disagreement and covering that in prayer and treating you as a fellow human being created in the image of God and talking more about it and praying more about it and trying to develop these strategies in tandem." The problem is they've been in competition. So one side will actively tank the other side's attempts because they think, well, it's going to make us look bad or something like that. And I'm like, look bad to who? The people that think killing babies is a sacrament? Like, this, nobody cares. Like, let's not lose our focus here. Let's stay focused on what God has called us to do. Remember why we're in this mission and why we're supposed to treat all people, even the opposition, with love and care and truth. Like, that's an important part of it. But I think if we look again to the abolition movement of the 1840s, the 1850s, the 1860s. This was a question and just such a fraught time because it had been brewing for so long. We tend to think of, oh yeah, poof, the Civil War happened and then suddenly the slaves were free. Emancipation Proclamation, 1863, yay. Like it took a long time. And literally even before the country became a unified entity in the Constitution, Benjamin Franklin was having these arguments. John Adams was having these arguments with Thomas Jefferson, with Samuel Rutledge, with our founders, and they basically tabled it. And they said, we're going to craft a compromise that'll try to make everybody happy so we can create this thing called the United States of America. And then our posterity is going to have to deal with this. And they did. And they fought one of the bloodiest wars in the history of the world at that point over this, in a large part. Over this question of whether or not to extend humanity, basic human rights to real human beings that were being treated as less than human. They were being treated as property. And I see significant parallels here and now. But my point in bringing that up is that both approaches were taken over the course of that time, leading eventually to the abolition. It's hard to imagine again that you could say, all right, we're going to fight for treating the slaves better. We're going to fight for more humane conditions. We're going to fight to end, you know, the Atlantic trade, so transatlantic slave trade, so that no new slaves are being brought in. We're going to maybe advocate for creating a place where they can be, where they can be safe, refuge cities, that if you know, the slaves ran away, then they can't face prosecution for being returned if they get to a sanctuary. That, you know, there were all of these midpoints, and again, I think principled incremental methods to try and improve the situation, but in the end, the only thing when you're talking about a question of, so that was a question of life and liberty. When you're talking about a question of life and death, there really isn't middle ground. So I think that's important for us to recognize. Either children are protected, either babies, either human lives are protected, or they're not. And so there is a certain duality to this conversation. It's basically a binary choice. Choose life, God says, choose life. So I guess in closing, which is everybody's favorite words in the sermon, right? Those are the two favorite words in closing, on this topic, Joel. It's hard because I've been so many places on this over the last 20 years, and I've seen it all. I've seen it all, and I've been disappointed at people that I thought were just solid pro-lifers, and then they turn and like run tail, or they're the ones that are in the committee meetings, kind of like, you know, ensuring that these bills die. And I'm like, oh, really, man, I thought you were on my team. Why? Why did you do this? But then I've seen the other side. There's like, oh, we're not even going to talk to those people because they're the compromisers over there. And I'm like, well, what if we could work together on an adoption bill? What if we could work together on foster care? What if we could work together on, you know, support for moms and pregnancy centers? So there's this whole gambit of things that can improve the pro-life perspective that can enhance life and the way that we protect life in our states and in our nation. But we, again, have to see the other person as a person for whom Jesus died. And that he thought it was worth, he thought they were worth his life. And so understanding it from that light, and understanding, again, historically speaking, you can do both. But you can't attack the other strategy. Like, that's a no-go. If you recognize you're both on the same team, then we should treat each other like it. And that has to go, that respect and that pact has to go both ways. So ultimately, no matter how principled your incrementalism, you have to be working towards the same goal. You can't undercut yourselves. A house divided against itself cannot stand.
So that was really good. We will wrap it up here. And I think of a couple of verses that'd be good for us. I know that Christians are on both sides of this. Or I'll say all sides of this in different places. But this is who we are. And so John 13, 34 and 35, you know, here's Jesus, the Passion Week, probably Tuesday, I'd say. He's going to be crucified in a few days, speaking very intimately, I think with some urgency to his disciples here that are far from having it all together. And John 13, 34 says, a new commandment I give to you. And it's a new commandment because they have now seen the example. It's been a commandment before, but now they've seen it in the manifestation of God as Jesus. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another just as I have loved you. That's the new part. You also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. And that's the big difference is when, you know, when we actually have that legitimate God standard, biblical standard of love, which is sacrificial, selfless, putting the other person before yourself and all of that, as Jesus loved them. You know, we see the example right there, plain. Then that's how they're actually going to know, hey, you're with Christ. So I think we need to even apply that to this realm. It is an extremely important issue, as we covered in this episode, I think, really well. And we think to ourselves, okay, but I need to love that baby. I need to love this fellow man, woman in front of me. I need to love, you know, even these people that are hating me right now. I need to love these people. And this is a fundamental idea. Of course, that love carries a lot of other ideas of speaking truth and, you know, being merciful, but, you know, carrying out justice. And, you know, there's lots of other things that are involved there. But you know, just putting God first. And they bear his image. And so you are honoring every human being in that sense, because you're honoring God. So that's a good way to, I think, kind of wrap things up. But Rebecca, since you are our honored guest, I'll let you have some closing remarks if you have any.
That's a dangerous thing to give a girl a microphone. I know. Thank you. It's been a joy to be with you guys. Like you said, I love C.S. Lewis. And what you just said made me think of his line that you've never looked into the eyes of a mere mortal all your life. You've been looking at immortal souls, and his idea that you don't have a soul, you are a soul, you have a body. And so what we're talking about here is, I think, the most important thing, you know, other than the gospel, other than understanding, like, on this side of eternity, this is the most important issue that I think God's people have to be active on at this time. You mentioned truth and love. I don't think you can really have one without the other. I think it has to be, truth has to be motivated by love, but because we love, we also have to speak the truth. But one last thought is, I think it is a uniquely Christian obligation to answer not only the question and see not only the question, but also the questioner. And understand that, again, for most people, this is not just theoretical. Like, you'll get into a lot of the flippant arguments or name calling online. That's not what this is about. This is about real people who have probably either participated in or in some way been touched by abortion. And not to mention that we're also like if we devalue human life, it's just even before they're born at the nascent stages, then it's just a short step from that to devalue us when we are vulnerable, when we're no longer contributing to society, the elder population, the disabled, the whatever that might be, the immigrant population, just people who are vulnerable on the edges of society. This issue encompasses every single one of those people. If one of us is not recognized as being made in the image of God, then every single one of us are in danger. You can't allow us to go down the eugenicist road because all the worst things in history happen at that point. So, not to end on a down note there, but I think that Christians have the unique opportunity to offer hope. And we have to answer both the question that's being asked and also the questioner, right? Because these are gospel conversations as well. This isn't just about a political position. It's how you treat the most vulnerable among us indicates who you are. And exactly as Christ said, they will know that you're my disciples by the way that you love. And that doesn't mean just covering over inconvenient conversations. It means treating everybody, both the preborn child and the angry protester that's trying to spit in your face. Like there's a run in the gamut. So either, whether they're your friend, your neighbor, or your enemy that's trying to persecute you, we've got one option, and that is to love them. And that's my daily prayer is to say, Lord, help me see people the way that you see them. Help me see that whoever I encounter today, help me see them as a person for whom Christ died and help me operate accordingly. And I think that's true across this discussion, across any sphere of influence that we may have. Let us speak the truth in love. I think it's necessary for us to do both. And that means, like it or not, that it's time for us to speak up. I mean, this travesty. This barbarism continues because of the silence of the church. Silence is permission. And if God's people spoke up with one voice and said, this is unacceptable, more than that, this is unnecessary. Because any young girl that finds herself, or a woman, anyone who finds herself, I say young girl, but girl of any age, really, anyone who finds themselves in the position of an unplanned pregnancy that is concerned, that is confused, that thinks she doesn't have support, come to the church. Come to the body of Christ and we will support you. We will protect you. We will give you love. If you're in an abusive situation, we'll make sure that you're protected, that you get justice. We will fight for you. We will stand in the gap for you. That's what she needs. Not abortion. The abortion solves nothing. It only creates more victims. It only creates more trauma. The church has to not only speak up for life, but also live out their pro-life.
That's good. So, if anyone wants to hear more from you, your podcast and things like that, whatever you tell us right now, we'll put the links in our description. So, how can they get a hold of you or learn more?
Sure. Easiest way is the show is called Faith Works Live. My name is Rebecca Haney, but it's a little spelled a little funky. So if you put down the link, just go to the link that Joel put down. We're also available on Facebook, on YouTube. We haven't been canceled yet, and on Rumble as well. So you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, Apple, Spotify, any place like that. Spreaker as well.
Awesome. Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for
Fantastic.
joining us.
Thank you guys.